Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the President's challenge to House Speaker Boehner to allow a vote to end the government shutdown and the surreal spectacle of a Republican congressman blaming a park ranger for the government closure. An expert on campaigns, elections, and political advertising, Lynn Vavrick, a professor of political science at UCLA and co-author of the new book, The Gamble, Choice and Chance in the 2012 election, joins us to discuss the tyranny of the minority as the Tea Party holds the nation hostage while threatening to tank the economy. Then we will speak with Graham Fuller, the former vice chairman of the National Intelligence Council at the CIA, about his article at Global Viewpoint, "Has Obama Inadvertently Broken the Mold in U.S. Foreign Policy?" We will discuss the unraveling of American exceptionalism, American unilateralism, America as the world policeman, and America as the architect of world order, as Obama backs away from the brink of a new war with Syria and opens up a dialogue with Iran. Then finally, we'll be joined in the studio by Steve Scroven, who is the host of Stand Up for Main Street, a political comedy benefit for Public Citizen, and comedian Mark Maron of the top-rated comedy podcast on iTunes, WTF with Mark Maron. And he's the author of the new memoir, Attempting Normal. We will discuss their new comedy special, Stand Up for Main Street, a political comedy benefit for Public Citizen, and the inadvertent comedy in the tragedy underway on Capitol Hill. And joining us now is Lynn Vavrick, who is a professor of political science and communication studies at the University of California in Los Angeles. Her research focuses on campaigns, elections, and political advertising. She is the author of Campaign Reform, Insights and Evidence, The Message Matters, The Economy and Presidential Campaigns, and is the co-author of The Logic of American Politics. Her latest book, just out, co-authored with John Sides, is The Gamble, Choice and Chance in the 2012 Election. Welcome to Background Briefing, Lynn Vavrick.
Thank you.
And at this point, it's uncertain as to whether John Boehner is getting a little wobbly here. Obviously, he's under a lot of pressure. The president called him out today and basically asked for an up or down vote, including the Democrats, of course. And apparently, the votes are there with the Democrats and the wavering Republicans. What do you think is likely to happen here in this standoff? Because my understanding is that they really want to hold on, the Republicans, until the October 17th deadline with the debt limit and use that as leverage. But I get the impression that the wheels are coming off.
Well, I think this is actually a rare moment in politics where I think citizens and voters have a lot of leverage right now. And so I suspect that what is likely to happen is, with each passing day, more and more people are going to become aware of what's happening, are going to form opinions about it, and contact their congressional offices. Little by little, word is going to get back to members of Congress that their constituents are not pleased with what's happening. And when that really starts to happen, when they sense that in the district they are paying costs for their behavior in the chamber, I think that's when you're really going to see things starting to change. Typically, I would say people don't pay enough attention to politics to make this kind of change happen, even in an election. But this is the kind of thing that touches people's lives in very strange ways that, you know, we don't necessarily think of. The fact that you've planned a vacation that you're not able to take. And so I think that there is this opportunity for people to play the pivotal role.
Well, apparently, if this is an anecdotal evidence here of the public weighing in, Congressman Randy Neugenbauer, a Republican of Texas, confronted a park ranger at the World War II Memorial, which is closed, and they were letting a group of veterans in, and he blamed her for the closure, which he, in fact, had voted for, and told her that she should be ashamed of herself. And the public weighed in. A crowd of onlookers got involved and loudly demanded that the congressman lay off the park ranger, and basically telling him that he was the problem, not her.
Yeah, it's an interesting exchange, because you see in this moment where a veteran says to the congressman, you know, I'm a veteran, I served for X number of years, and she's just doing her job. You know, you're the person. The congressman says to the park ranger, you should be ashamed of yourself. And so this veteran then weighs in and says to the congressman, well, you should be ashamed of yourself. And in that moment, the member of Congress still tries to politicize it. You know, well, it's, you know, the veteran says, you know, I'm unemployed and I can't get a job, you know, and the politics comes out, and the congressman says, that's because of Harry Reid. And this idea that we're always in that partisan political mode, I think that's another thing that if you look at the polling results, slowly but surely, the average, you know, citizen is getting a little bit tired of that kind of partisan vitriol.
So do you think that the Republicans can hang on until the 17th? I mean, today, Speaker Boehner signaled that, not publicly, but privately signaled that he doesn't want to go over the cliff and put the full faith and credit of the United States at risk. So I assume that he's giving up his major leverage here. So is this thing going to go on until the October 17 deadline?
I think if we had any idea of what the answer to that question was, you know, it'd be great. But I think really there's so much uncertainty about everyone's incentives here, what everyone's end goals are, that I think it's really hard to know. And I think we can say a couple of things with more certainty. And one is that, you know, if people in communities around the country start to contact their members, particularly Republican members of Congress, and say, you know, resolve this, or, you know, there'll be consequences at the ballot box, not in the primary, in the general election, right? So as they start to hear from people, I think that's a sure way that there is some softening. The second thing is that, you know, if Boehner decides to exercise his leadership role in terms of agenda control, that would be another way that things would start to change. Now, he is sort of indicating that that's what he's going to do. But again, the past is the best predictor of the future. And I'm not sure that if you were a betting person, you would bet a lot of money on the fact that he's going to do that or do what he says he's going to do there.
Again, I'm speaking with Lynn Vavreck, who's a professor of political science and communication study at the University of California in Los Angeles. Her research focuses on campaigns, elections, and political advertising. And she's the author of Campaign Reform, Insights and Evidence, The Message Matters, The Economy and Presidential Campaigns, and is the co-author of The Logic of American Politics. Her latest book just out, co-authored with John Sides, is The Gamble, Choice and Chance in the 2012 Election. But of course, what's happening now is in sort of defiance, as if the 2012 election didn't happen. Obamacare, or the Affordable Care Act, as it's correctly known as, was voted on, and the Supreme Court upheld it. And the Republicans are trying to relitigate something that's already law. So I don't understand. Is this, maybe you're more of a historian than I am, but I don't know that this is how you do business. Hold the full faith and credit of the United States hostage on an argument that you've already lost.
It is an unusual situation for sure. And, you know, one of the things that we talk about in The Gamble is this idea that after every presidential election, the side that wins views or interprets the election result as the public speaking, that there's a mandate for the policies that their particular side was advocating. And, you know, we go through a couple of examples demonstrating that that's always the wrong thing to believe, that very few elections are indications of wholesale mandates for the winning party's policies. And so I think that while you're right, this particular action is unusual, it's also important to remember that, you know, this was an election that was, you know, the margin was not as great as it was in 2008. Mostly that's because of the economy coming back slowly. But still, among every group in the population, the share of Obama vote went down. Among almost every group, Latinos and Asians, the vote share went up a little bit. But, you know, people are not feeling as great about President Obama as they were even, you know, 6 years ago. So the interpretation of the election result as being, you know, a validation of his policies or his first term, I think, was always misguided.
You mean he won handily. He had a tremendous victory in the Electoral College, and I don't think most presidents don't do as well second time around. I can't think of anybody that's done better the second time around. Perhaps Roosevelt did. But are you saying that he somehow didn't win or doesn't have that legitimacy of having won the second election, I think fairly handily, certainly in terms of the Electoral College? Because, you know, the Republicans met after the election at Williamsburg, and that's when they made this decision not to negotiate with the White House and not to negotiate with the Senate and to force the Democrats to come to them. Didn't get a lot of press on the liberal press, but it got a lot of press on the conservative press. We have reached the culmination of that strategy. So what seems to have happened is that the Republicans decided that somehow the results of the 2012 elections were invalid.
I think that, you know, obviously we don't make the argument in the book that, you know, Obama didn't win the election. It's the interpretation of what winning means. And winners almost always interpret their victory to mean a wholesale mandate for the policies, their policies, over the policies of the other party. And that's almost always hubris. In the same way that when people look back at the election and they say, why did the winner win? Most often people want, oh, because his campaign was better. And so, you know, you'd say Romney lost because he didn't run his campaign, you know, his ground game didn't function as well as Obama's. Like, these are all the conventional arguments that you get. But, you know, the winner doesn't have to have won the better campaign. Sometimes things like the state of the economy, there's a lot of fundamental conditions that affect how these campaigns are played out, just, you know, not because of the decisions the candidates make, but just because of chance circumstances. And so this is another one of these kind of things that happens all the time. The party that wins thinks there's support for their policies. And that's not always the case.
Well, but if it's not the case, then how do you justify the losers in this case? Not that the Republicans lost the House, but the reason that they decided to have this no negotiating stance following their election defeat, and obviously Romney thought he'd won, at least his wife did. So they were, I think, somewhat surprised by the results. And shortly thereafter, meeting at Williamsburg, they decided to basically not to play ball, to basically be hard-nosed. And it would seem in part to do with the fact that there's been so much gerrymandering going on that there are enough of these safe seats that they can basically play to their gallery and forget the National Gallery. Because, after all, the Democrats got, I think, over a million more votes in the House than the Republicans did. That gives you an example of how gerrymandered it is.
And I think that this is, again, where it comes back to this point about constituencies in these districts all over the country. And so the longer this goes on, because I think everybody recognizes that this is not how progress is made in politics. And so the longer this goes on, particularly with the stakes getting higher each day, people, I think, around the country are going to start to voice their concerns about the strategy. And that's, I think, going to be the nudge that really causes things to change.
But it would seem to me that there's a difference here between basically playing hardball and going on strike. And it seems that the Republicans have upped the ante, because all of this shutdown is over, trying to relitigate something that's already passed. So they're absolutely refusing to budge on anything in the present, but then they're going back to the past to try and relitigate Obamacare. I mean, to me, that's obstruction twofold. I mean,
and I think it's actually even slightly more complicated than that, because then now the argument that they're advancing, that, you know, you can see very clearly being articulated in the incident you talked about at the World War II memorial, that the Republican congressman then tries to suggest that, you know, it's the Democrats who won't compromise, who won't have a conversation with his side about resolving this. So it's even slightly more complicated than just saying, we don't like this thing that is the law of the land. It then is an extra layer. And because of that, because the other side won't talk about this thing that is the law of the land, they are the people who won't compromise. And for me, thinking about the average person in the population, that additional layer, it gets quite complicated for people at that point, which is, again, why I think the position is untenable. They will not be able to change people's minds about this who aren't already with them. And so at some point, people will start to get very angry.
But in terms of this sudden about-face, where now they're saying that we're the reasonable ones and the Democrats won't talk to us, mm-hmm. the strategy up until now has been the reverse. You know, Patty Murray's been trying to get them to talk to her forever, and they simply have refused to negotiate. And now all of a sudden they're saying that they're the ones who want to negotiate, but they want to negotiate over something that's already been voted on and approved by the Supreme Court. So I find it sort of surreal. I mean, if there are enough people out there that believe it, maybe they can get away with it. But doesn't it come down to a simple reality here where if people are paying attention to what's happening, it's pretty clear, without being partisan, who's at fault here?
I think a lot of the partisanship is exactly the way to understand the rhetoric that is happening here. And a lot of this is to give people who are supporters already the necessary tools to have conversations with other people about what's happening. So they have to go out there and say, you know, we're willing to have conversations, and the other side isn't, you know, even though that's sort of not what the reality has been leading up to this. But the fact that, you know, they can say that out loud now, that, you know, tells their supporters what to say to other people in communities around the country. Now, that's a very different thing from whether that argument is persuading anybody. And, you know, I have not seen any polling data on this because it would be very hard to do this kind of polling in real time. But I'd be willing to bet a lot of money that argument actually, it has not changed any minds. You know, this is not the kind of argumentation that is going to be persuasive for people who don't have an opinion. It's for people who are already on their side.
Well, Lynn Vavreck, I thank you so much for joining us, and we really haven't had a chance to talk about The Gamble, your new book, which we'll have to revisit later, because obviously things are pretty, shall we say, interesting at the moment.
Exactly.
I thank you for joining us.
You're welcome.
Again, I've been speaking with Lynn Vavreck, who's a professor of political science and communication study at the University of California in Los Angeles. Her research focuses on campaigns, elections, and political advertising, and she's the author of Campaign Reform, Insights and Evidence, The Message Matters, The Economy, and Presidential Campaigns, and is the co-author of The Logic of American Politics. Her latest book, just out, co-authored with John Sides, is The Gamble, Choice and Chance in the 2012 Election. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back talking about whether Obama has inadvertently broken the mold in U.S. foreign policy. You can't hide your lying eyes, and your smile is a thin disguise. I thought by now you'd realize there ain't no. Oh! Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Graham Fuller, who is the former vice chairman of the National Intelligence Council at the CIA. He also served as the CIA's Kabul station chief and is currently a professor of history at Simon Fraser University. Graham Fuller has lived and worked in the Muslim world for nearly two decades and is the author of numerous books about the Middle East, including The Future of Political Islam and most recently A World Without Islam. His latest article at Global Viewpoint is, Has Obama Inadvertently Broken the Mold in U.S. Foreign Policy? Welcome to Background Briefing, Graham Fuller.
Thank you, Ian.
So do you think that John Kerry's off-the-cuff remark at the press conference in London and the sudden switch in from bombing Syria to talking to both Syria, Iran, and the Russians, do you think, as you say, we've strayed into the political reforging of American foreign policy?
I think we may have strayed into it. It's going to take some time before we can see what comes of all of this. But I find it difficult to believe that this was all carefully arranged by Obama and the Russians and Iranians and others to suddenly change the game plan, back away from what seemed like an imminent bombing of Syria, and to join up with the Russians on removal of chemical weapons from Syria. I'm pleased. I'm delighted with it. I think it's a step in the right direction, but it's too soon to know whether this is a very conscious plan or just, as I say, something they stumbled into.
But in your article at Global Viewpoint, Has Obama Inadvertently Broken the Mold in U.S. Foreign Policy? You talk about the unraveling of American exceptionalism, American unilateralism, America as the world policeman, and the architect of world order as Obama backs away from the brink of a new war with Syria and opens up a dialogue with Iran. It seems to me that what could be going on here, I think, is an even bigger fissure, and that is that you have this peculiar alliance between Saudi Arabia and Israel in the sense that they're both against Iran and both backing the coup in Egypt, for example, against democracy. And you've got the possibility that we could maybe make a deal with the other side in this schism between Shiism and Sunniism. And in many ways, it would seem to me that if you look at the ledger on who's been screwing us over the last few decades, you can't help feeling that our friends the Saudis, who after all are the ones that allowed all the heart-eating jihadis into Syria, which has played right into Assad's hands, have been, shall we say, duplicitous all along. And maybe is that at the end of the day where this thing could end up?
Well, that's interesting comments, Ian. I don't know whether I would call the Saudis duplicitous in this, because I think it's maybe perhaps a little more direct. But first of all, I think it's worth unpacking this whole problem here. The struggle in the Middle East right now is currently, we see it between Saudi Arabia and Iran, is usually cast in terms of Shiites versus Sunni eternal struggle. I really don't think that's what this is truly all about. Essentially, Saudi Arabia is, and its fellow monarchs in the area, I think they're terrified at the prospect of expanding popular uprisings, popular revolutions, indeed overthrow of monarchies and the establishment of republics. So it's not that Iran so much is Shiite. I think Iran, from very early on since its revolution, has been very outspoken in calling for an end to monarchy. It's said that monarchy is not Islamic, and that is correct. It is not the ideal form of government in Islam. And Iran represented kind of a new revolutionary force when that revolution took place in 1979. So the Saudis have always been very nervous about it, and especially since the Arab publics have often admired Iran for their guts and being able to, willingness to stand up against U.S. power and be heard, as opposed to cringing like most of their own leaders do in the area. So I think in the end, Saudis are hoping to close down any kind of change, radical moves, uprisings, or whatever else. Certainly they're entitled to do that, and God knows change is going to be messy, but at this point they represent the forces of counter-revolution in the Middle East.
And do you think that if there is, in other words, can you make the calculus that maybe we backed the wrong side in the Sunni-Shia split, that at the end of the day, perhaps you can deal with the Iranians, and obviously their own people are pushing the envelope, as they did under in the Green Revolution and continue to do, whereas the other more reactionary side, particularly Wahhabism, which is radicalizing Islam in Pakistan, in Nigeria, and all around the world, arguably, is basically really, in effect, what this so-called war on terror is about.
Yes, it is, but it's interesting to think back to the days of the Iranian Revolution, when many of the Shiites in the Gulf, many of whom had a raw deal as minorities in the Gulf, were then themselves more revolutionary, and Iran was spouting the death to America and this whole revolutionary vision. At that point, Washington was thinking, oh my God, Shiite bad, Sunni good. And now things have sort of seemed to have changed a little bit, especially with bin Laden 10 years ago with 9/11, when the pendulum began to swing the other way and people were saying, oh my God, Sunni bad, Shiite good. In the end, I don't think we want to change sides on this. We don't have a dog in this fight. As I said earlier, I don't really think this is all about Sunni versus Shiite so much as it is about change and trying to cling on to the status quo. After all, I mean, the Iranians have supported, for example, the Muslim Brotherhood movement in Palestine. It's called Hamas. And they've never had any trouble with this. The Iranians have always had fairly decent approach, taken some ideas from the Muslim Brotherhood, which is a very Sunni organization. But this hasn't been this sort of big split. So I don't think it's good for the Middle East or good for us or good for anybody else in the region if the United States kind of weighs in for the moment on one side or the other. The issue is really about change.
Again, I'm speaking with Graham Fuller, who's the former vice chairman of the National Intelligence Council. He served as the CIA's Kabul station chief and is currently professor of history at Simon Fraser University. He has lived and worked in the Muslim world for nearly two decades and is the author of numerous books about the Middle East, including The Future of Political Islam and most recently A World Without Islam. His latest article at Global Viewpoint is Has Obama Inadvertently Broken the Mold in U.S. Foreign Policy? So it's clear that the American people are ahead of the interventionists, whether they're liberal interventionists or neoconservative interventionists, and it may have a lot to do with the war weariness. In many ways, maybe we are a spent force. You've argued before when I've spoken to you over the years, Graham Fuller, and I think we were among the first people to talk about the Iraq war before it began, when everybody was beating the drum and all excited about it, that it'd be a quick victory followed by a slow defeat. And it's clear that we are in many ways a spent force, and that the problem, as you have pointed out in the past, is our footprint in that part of the world. So if we remove our footprint, what do you think will be our role?
Well, as I mentioned in this article about whether Obama has inadvertently broken the mold of American foreign policy, which, by the way, was also in Christian Science Monitor and Huffington Post and other places if people want to look for it, I argue that the problem actually for the United States has been endless interventionism in the Muslim world for a very long time. I think a lot of Americans tend to think that history began with 9/11. In other words, that here we were just minding our business, trying to run the world, keep it on an even keel, when suddenly we were attacked out of left field by crazies. We indeed were attacked out of left field, and it was an outrage and a crime, but history didn't begin then. They felt that they were reacting to longtime American policies that they had objected to, including the stationing of American troops all over the Middle East and what the Pentagon calls our footprint. So I think the problem really, from the point of view of American policy, is how much longer are we going to be involved in military intervention? If I really thought that going into Iraq, going into Afghanistan, going into, in this case, say, Syria or Iran, would really change the situation for the better and could bring about an excellent solution, I might consider that. But how dumb do we have to be before we watch two or three of these interventions, which have been not only total military failures, we're about to get out with our tail between our legs and declare a victory in Afghanistan, but it's nothing of the kind. The situation invariably is worse and more radicalized and more people hating the United States and U.S. policies than ever before. So, you know, Al-Qaeda keeps reinventing itself and reinventing itself as more locals in these areas get killed, their families get killed, and they're willing to sign up with some, Al-Qaeda 2.0 or whatever it happens to be in the Middle East.
Well, and as you point out in your article, Graham Fuller, has Obama inadvertently broken the mold in U.S. foreign policy while we have been mired in the Middle East, essentially making enemies? The U.S. Has ignored the 5.54 million dead in the Congo. And so there's no question that our intervention is selective. Do you think that, for example, there's been some fairly serious uprisings in Sudan, and of course the leader there is been indicted by the International Criminal Court. His own people are rising up against him, not just the southern Sudanese and the people in Darfur. And the Security Council tried to take it up, and Russia vetoed them. So on the one hand, we're working with Russia on extricating or not getting deeper into Syria. But Russia's not necessarily playing a helpful role. And I take it the Chinese aren't, because they don't want intervention. They don't want anybody talking about what the Russians are doing to the Tibetans and what the Chinese are doing to the Tibetans and what the Russians are doing to the Chechens. So are we better off not having a moral position at all, or should we have a moral position that's clear and consistent?
Well, it's very difficult for big powers to be clear and consistent on things, because no two situations are the same. And yes, it's nice to be consistent, and I urge greater consistency on all kinds of issues where we're wildly inconsistent. You just pointed up one that I'd mentioned in the article. We talk about over 100,000 people dead in Syria, and that's tragic and terrible, and hopefully will come to an end. But we hear all about that, and we don't hear anything about the 5.4 million dead in Sudan, in Congo, over the last decade. So, yeah, selectivity, we are going to be selective, but I think it's very hard to be highly indignant and posturing in a moral position when we're very selective. We like democracy when it will overthrow our enemies. I've often said that, you know, democracy is a weapon against our enemies, but it's never a gift to our friends. We champion democracy when it works in our favor, but if the Palestinians vote for the wrong people, then we reject the whole thing. If Islamists win in Egypt, then we're very unhappy because the wrong people won. So, you know, to me, the real bottom line here is getting American military footprints out of the area. That seems to me to be the single biggest cause of grief and anguish and anger among Muslims in the Arab world and beyond. I don't think the departure of America is going to solve everything, but I think it's a good start in the right direction, especially since none of these interventions have led to anything but greater grief and greater chaos in every single one of those countries that we've been intervening in. We can't solve all the world's problems. And once we enter into the game, then we become part of the equation, and people line up within Syria or Afghanistan or wherever else as to whether they're against the Americans or work with the Americans, and it ceases to be people working among themselves trying to work this out, and it becomes all about everything about America.
Well, Graham Fuller, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
My pleasure, Ian. Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Graham Fuller, who is the former vice chairman of the National Intelligence Council at the CIA. He also served as the CIA's Kabul station chief and is currently a professor of history at Simon Fraser University. Graham Fuller has lived and worked in the Muslim world for nearly two decades and is the author of numerous books about the Middle East, including The Future of Political Islam and most recently A World Without Islam. His latest article at Global Viewpoint and the Huffington Post is Has Obama Inadvertently Broken the Mold in U.S. Foreign Policy? We're going to take a brief station break and be joined in the studio by Steve Groven, the host of Stand Up for Main Street, a political comedy benefit for Public Citizen, and comedian Mark Maron. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining me in the studio is Steve Scroven, who's the board member at Public Citizen and the host of Stand Up for Main Street, a political comedy benefit for Public Citizen in its second year. After beginning his career, is it the third year, I think, after beginning his career as a stand-up comedian, he went on to write for television shows, including Seinfeld, Everybody Loves Raymond, and Till Death, and co-wrote, produced, and directed An Unreasonable Man, the documentary about the life and career of Ralph Nader. And also joining us will be Mark Maron, who has for 15 years has been writing and performing raw, honest, and thought-provoking comedy for print, stage, radio, and television, a legend in the stand-up community. He has appeared on HBO, Conan, Letterman, Two Comedy Central Presents, and recently co-wrote and starred in his own IFC TV series, Maron. He has the new memoir, Attempting Normal, and is the host of the top-rated comedy podcast on iTunes, WTF with Mark Maron. Let me begin with you, Steve Scroven. This special that's coming up, I believe it's the third one.
It's
right?
The third, yeah.
Yes, I got that wrong. But this is, of course, you know, I look for people to talk to all the time. Who are the smartest people best connected to the story in the news? And I often turn to Public Citizen, and some of the best people that I've talked to are there. So it's a great resource.
It's a legendary advocacy group. You know, we wouldn't have airbags. We wouldn't know about toxic shock syndrome or red dye number two, or they've gotten 24 dangerous drugs off the market. We wouldn't know the truth about all these free trade deals. It was Public Citizen that got into it first and say, wait a minute, there's something going on here in the mid-90s. So yeah, it's kind of watching over us.
And you're going to be – is this comedy sweetening the bitter pill of politics? Is that what's going on here?
Yeah, and it's not even a political comedy show. It's the comics are doing what they do. I told them they don't have to be political. They just have to be funny. The idea is I was a stand-up comedian and a comedy writer, and being on the board, I was trying to figure out what could I do to draw attention to the group, to help raise money for them. And I thought my strength, what I do know how to do, is put on a show. And I found in my life that getting a point across comedically is far more powerful than any other way I could do it. So I thought this would this is what I'll do. I'll get a bunch of comedian friends. We'll have a comedy evening, and it'll be laughs and inspiration.
Well, you know, it's often said that comedy and tragedy are a breath away. And
sure.
Of course, the two famous faces
right.
Merging there. And at this point, I don't think it could be clearer. I mean, the tragedy of this country behaving like a banana republic and about to truly commit economic suicide if the Republicans go ahead with what they're saying they're going to do. And at the same time, you know, some. If you watch them, they're all reading from the same bad script.
Right.
It does seem like, I guess, bad stand-up, right?
They're terrible stand-ups. They're terrible stand-ups. But and this speaks to one of Public Citizen's biggest campaigns, which is money in politics and overturning Citizens United. And we wouldn't be going through a lot of this nonsense if we didn't have billionaires ready to fund candidates in Republican primaries that didn't take this extreme position. So that's all the more important to support this.
Right. Well, I guess that explains the alternative universe, right, that these guys are in because, you know, if they actually took a vote, which Boehner won't let them take a vote, and Obama goaded him today to take a vote,
right,
we know that this insanity would end immediately, right?
Exactly. But they want to hold on to their jobs
so this
in the primaries.
This is the tyranny of the minority.
Right.
Paying fealty to the Koch brothers and screwing the country and talking to their own echo chamber in their district.
Exactly. And I just spent 2 months in Russia. I was working on the Russian version of Everybody Loves Raymond. And it was interesting to be there for that long and talk to a lot of people, both expatriates and Russian nationals. And it's basically what they have there is a corporate oligarchy. And Putin is the head CEO. And although we are not there yet, if the Koch brothers, people like these corporate plutocrats get their way, we could very easily make that leap to that same thing.
Well, I've often covered that very issue to the point where I've gotten mail saying, stop using the word oligarchy, because I've so often rhetorically questioned of how much we are still a democracy and the extent to which we've become a plutocracy.
Yeah.
And it's pretty hard not to defend it. And I don't know whether you've seen this new movie by Robert Reich.
I've heard of it, yes. He's talking about the income disparity and inequality, yeah.
And it's a very, very good piece of work. And I met with him recently and, you know, we're talking about how many congressmen are left that are actually doing the people's business. And, you know, according to a lot of insiders, it's only a handful. I mean, that's how much they've been captured by money.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And, you know, we saw it in the last election, even though they didn't hold sway. There were certain individuals who could buy their way into the game, and the rest of us can't.
So are you hoping to start a revolution, a counter-revolution? I mean, it's always good to sugar the bitter pill of politics with a little humor.
I'm not a revolutionary, and people say to me all the time, you know, because I'm just a comedy writer, and you know, don't the problem seem so intractable, and the forces arrayed against you so big? And yeah, and there's a good chance we're going to lose a lot of battles, but I figure, if that's going to happen, I'm going to go down with my boots on.
And again, I'm speaking with Steve Scroven, who's a board member at Public Citizen and host of Stand Up for Main Street, a political comedy benefit for Public Citizen in its third year. After beginning his career as a stand-up comedian, he went on to write for television shows including Seinfeld, Everybody Loves Raymond, and Till Death, and co-wrote, produced, and directed An Unreasonable Man, the documentary about the life and career of Ralph Nader. Let's run through who you've got here. We've got Dylan Brody, Reuben Paul, Carol Leifer, Greg Fitzsimmons, Alan Harvey,
Alan Havey.
Of The Office, and Betsy Salkin.
Yeah.
And so how do people get – what do people do to get to this show?
Go to citizen.org, and on the homepage you'll see Stand Up for Main Street. Click on that, and there will not only be tickets, but there will be a little highlight reel from last year's show.
So when you say that, you know, you're not necessarily going to, it's not necessarily about politics, but you're doing, it's essentially a fundraiser for
it's a fundraiser, and yeah, it is basically about politics, because right. Public Citizen is in D.C. They're inside the Beltway, and they are dealing with all of these issues. It's nonpartisan. But it's I'm just telling the comedians that they don't necessarily have to talk about politics. They just need to be funny, and that's what we're leavening it with.
So I don't know what happened to Mark, by the way. Is there any way we can get in touch with him? I must say, have you read his book, Attempting Normal?
I haven't. I've been in Russia for 2 months.
Oh, that's right. You've been in Russia.
Yes.
Right. They're going to watch the same show that you did here?
Yes. Well, yeah. It's called The Voronins there. And
The Voronin?
The Voronins.
The crow. Verona means crow in Russian.
Oh, maybe. Yeah.
The Voronins?
That I didn't know.
That's the name of them.
That's the name of the family.
Right.
So it's not Everybody Loves Raymond. It's called The Voronins.
Uh-huh.
And Phil Rosenthal did a documentary a few years back called Exporting Raymond.
Right.
Which was about the beginning of this process where they adapted our episodes.
Right.
And they adapted our episodes. And since they run the show every day, they blew through about 200 of our episodes immediately in about a year and a half. And so they're writing original episodes.
Uh-huh.
And so I went over there to help them come up with stories to
– Well, at least they're not stealing it like the Chinese, right?
That's right. Yeah.
Right. So I don't know, but I was going to ask you about Mark's book, Attempting Normal, because, I mean, it has some of the most hilarious stuff about, you know, the people at his job felt so sorry for him when he first started out that they arranged for him to lose his virginity, you know.
Yeah.
And I wanted to ask him about some of these escapades. Anyway, we're hoping for him to join us here and discuss further this upcoming special Stand Up for Main Street, a political comedy benefit for Public Citizen in its third year. And do you think that comedy is the best way? I mean, as I was saying earlier, you know, it sort of makes you weep what's happening in Capitol Hill.
In my experience,
it's bad comedy. It really is.
Well, that's not the comedy. It's you know, it's the bread and butter of like the Daily Show and the Colbert Report. And because it is so bad like that,
right?
And in a way, you know, you'll often hear Jon Stewart or Stephen Colbert when one of these really crazy guys, from the Republican Party, like Rick Perry, when he leaves, they miss him because he's a lot of material,
right?
A lot of good material. So perversely, you kind of it's your bread and butter, the crazy it gets when you're a comedian.
Well, who was it now? James Carville. That said, that politics is show business for ugly people. And I tell you, just looking at television and watching that Republican congressman berate this poor woman from the Park Service, you know.
Yes, I saw that.
But what was great about it was that citizens intervened and said, enough already. And they took this guy to task, and this veteran took him to task. And how dare you blame this woman for the shutdown? It's you guys, you know. What planet are they on?
I don't know. I think it's desperation. I think the Republican Party –
Planet desperation, right?
I think the Republican Party knows that it's dying out. It's got to redefine itself in some way. And they are desperately trying to hang on to whatever power they have. And I think the Affordable Care Act, while it's not what I would prefer, I'd prefer a single payer as would Public Citizen. I think they're worried more that people will like it, and it will, and it's not their thing, even though it was their original idea.
Yeah, it originally came from the Heritage Foundation.
Exactly, right? And that's why they're working all these things to suppress the vote, because this is, and they're trying to buy their way into elections through Citizens United. These are all strategies to hold on to power, and I think it's out of desperation. I think it's in some sort of death throes or reformation if they're going to survive with the same name.
Well, it's hard to believe that you know, with that sort of bad comedy and with Carville's, you know, show business for ugly people, and they sure as hell are a pretty ugly bunch. They're also ugly in their attitude to the president. You can't help feeling that so much of this irrational anger is seated in some kind of racism. And I there's never been a president like this that's been so disrespected and he just won an election, and they all met right after the election, decided that our strategy will be not to talk to him and not to talk to the Democratic Senate, and force them to come to us. And this has all culminated in this current shutdown of the government, and they're about to pull the trigger on the other barrel of the shotgun, which is defaulting on our debt.
And it's they don't realize he's a Republican. He's an Eisenhower Republican. He's actually one of you.
Well, they've admitted that, or at least the punditry has admitted that Reagan couldn't even get elected in the current Republican.
Yeah. Could you imagine if Obama had ever used the phrase like a military-industrial complex? He'd be accused of being a communist.
Right.
That was Eisenhower. Right. Eisenhower had some of the biggest infrastructure government spending of all time with the national highway system. And so – yeah, that's the irony of this.
Well, I guess our comedian is a no show here. I don't know what happened to him.
I'm sorry about that.
He's I don't know.
He will be at the event. He promised me.
He better, right? Okay, I wanted to ask him about some of his extraordinary sexcapades.
I was involved in none of them.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well.
They are, I must say, pretty extraordinary. So tell us about then what kind of an evening we're going to have.
You know what's great about this evening, Ian, as opposed to a lot of fundraisers in L.A., is it's very – you don't have to get dressed up. Mm-hmm. You don't have to eat rubber chicken. You don't have to listen to long, boring speeches. Mm-hmm. And you're in a theater with the top comics in town, and it's – you're in by 6:30. You're out by 8:30 on a Sunday evening. You can still catch Murder, She Wrote, although that's not on anymore.
So you're catering to the blue hair section.
I'm getting blue hair. No, I'm – well, you know what? I'm catering to people who have kids. I'm actually catering the event myself too. I'll be passing out hors d'oeuvres. But that's what kind of makes it. It's like nice, clean, in, out. You have laughs. You feel inspired and it's a good model.
So let me. I'm looking here for the list of comedians that I mentioned here that will be at the event, because and some of them you can tell me more about them.
Sure.
Okay, we know about Mark Dylan Brody.
Dylan Brody, who's actually been on KPFK a lot, with Jimmy Dore and David Feldman.
Oh, Jimmy Dore, right.
And he's a very funny guy, and he is probably going to be very political. He's very opinionated in that way.
Right.
And he wrote his own book about his relationship with his father, which was kind of interesting. We've got
Ruben Paul.
Ruben Paul, who was recommended to me, and I just met him last week, and he's an African-American guy who is very funny. And we've got Alan Havey, who is one of my oldest friends. We actually started in stand-up together.
Now, he's in The Office. Which one does he play?
I'm not sure what he does in The Office, but he just did a stint on Mad Men.
Oh, he did? Oh.
Yeah, and he's been on Letterman all the time, and he's one of the best. There are a lot of these people who are not necessarily national names,
right,
but they are on the road and they are the best stand-ups around.
And Greg Fitzsimmons?
Greg Fitzsimmons. It falls in that same category,
right,
and has got his own very popular podcast called FitzDog.
Right.
And
Carol Leifer. She's on the Letterman show a lot, right?
Carol Leifer, yes. And she had her own show. She's also a Seinfeld writer. And has written a couple of books too, and Carol's another one that I go back with.
Right. And Betsy Salkin?
Betsy Salkin is actually I met her when she did a smaller house kind of party for me a few years back, and she's also very funny and been on the Tonight Show.
So again, I'm talking with Steve Scroven, who is a board member of Public Citizen and the host of Stand Up for Main Street, a political comedy benefit for Public Citizen in its third year. And he has written, of course, for Seinfeld, Everybody Loves Raymond, Until Death, and co-wrote and directed An Unreasonable Man, the documentary about the life and career of Ralph Nader. And I take it that in many ways, Ralph Nader's enduring legacy is Public Citizen, right? I mean, that came out of the settlement with GM, right?
Yeah, as an institution, yeah. That he founded it in 1971 with Joan Claybrook and Sid Wolfe and Alan Morrison. And it's been – you know, it's the reason we have airbags in cars. It's the reason we have, you know, Clean Air Act, Clean Water Act, some great victories throughout the 40-year history and so over such a wide portfolio of issues. They were the original No Nukes group. It was nuclear physicist who came to Ralph in the early 70s and said, you know, there's a real problem here with nuclear power. Mm-hmm. And they organized – he formed a group called Critical Mass, which is now the energy group at Public Citizen, headed by Tyson Slocum. And they organized for years and years and raised awareness and got people sort of knowledgeable and conscious of this issue. And then when Three Mile Island happened in 1979, they were ready. And that was the No Nukes movement that culminated in a huge demonstration in Battery Park in New York and 3 days of concerts in Madison Square Garden. There's a movie called the No Nukes movie. And they prevented a nuclear power plant from being permitted from 1978 until last year, mm-hmm. when the Obama administration, our Eisenhower Republican, permitted one in Georgia.
Well, just in closing, since you just got back from Russia, otherwise known as KGB Incorporated, and,
yeah.
You know, Putin regulates the oligarchs and he's trampling democracy wherever he can, and he's now beating up on gays. And so what's your sense, just having come back from that country, in terms of where we're heading? I mean, it seems like we're not that far away from an oligarchy, and we obviously have a freer press. It seems like there's a more crude version of where we're heading.
It is, and I would say the difference is when I talk to writers in a writer's room. You know, politics is always, you know, in current events, we always talking about that kind of stuff. In Russia, they just shrug their shoulders. They don't even bother talking about it. It's not worth.
There's no politics.
No, it's just they shrug, and it's because they don't have a free press, and they don't have institutions like Public Citizen, NGOs, mm-hmm. and organizations that can defy power without consequence, yeah. And that's why. Here, even though the forces arrayed against us are so powerful, we don't have any excuse to shrug. And that's why I got involved in Public Citizen and urge other people to contribute.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here, Steve Scroven.
Thank you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Steve Scroven, who's a board member at Public Citizen and the host of Stand Up for Main Street, a political comedy benefit for Public Citizen in its third year. After beginning his career as a stand-up comedian, he went on to write for television shows, including Seinfeld, Everybody Loves Raymond, and Till Death, and co-wrote, produced, and directed An Unreasonable Man, the documentary about the life and career of Ralph Nader. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Colin Black. This program is available for podcast at ianmasters.com, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. The guy that lived next door in 305.